resume the hearing. Mr. Todd, thank you for that bundle of paper. Would you like to present your case?
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. Appearing for Glendean Holdings Limited, Glendean Limited and Richard and Sarah Burden. Just before I refer to my submissions, we produced for you, hopefully with something which might be helpful, in terms of an understanding of the various legal positions in relation to the land which is subject to the submission. So if we look at the overall plan, all of the area outlined in the heavy black line is including the land to the north, being lot 1, DP41892, is land that is subject to the submission. The land is dissected by some crown land, as is shown, over which Contact Energy have an operating easement. And then we have the various QLDC ownership in relation to land which is part of which is recreation reserve, part of which is leased by Glendean Holdings Limited, but all of which is used in part as a camping ground, other than the area to the north and to the area to the west, which is the lot 2 DP418972. And then we also have shown where the Noahunga area is, at the southern end of the land and the crown land, and then almost you'll, and if you look behind you at the map shown, it gives you a wider context in relation to the locale with the Hawea Township and the Hawea foreshore. So the land outside of the land owned by the council is owned as part of Glendean Station. Glendean Holdings Limited is the entity which has basically been established to own and operate the camping ground facility, and it is Mr. and Mrs. Burden, common shareholding and directorship of those companies. They also have a desire to significantly upgrade the camping ground facility, and over time to expand it, and they will give you evidence in relation to that issue. Part of the frustrations that they have had in undertaking development to date is that they are required to obtain approvals both in terms of the Resource Management Act and in terms of the Reserves Act, and the lease, the terms of the lease that they have over the leased area. In light of issues that have been raised in relation or to in the reports from the officers, for example, about the ability to basically develop this whole site, that simply can't occur because anything that is undertaken there, including the removal of any trees, requires the approval of the council. That's in effect the council land, which is a significant part of this property. And as you will have appreciated from the evidence, there is a proposal that there be a buffer strip over effectively the land which is owned by Glendean Limited, which will provide for protection in terms of screen planting or views from the road, albeit that there are intermittent views that you can see already of some development. So development has been far from a greenfield site, development has and use of this land for a camping ground has occurred over the last 50 years. Obviously, at certain times of the year, this is very heavily used, and then it's basically for the rest of the year that the desire of the Burdens is to enable the development of the camp to make it sustainable year-round and to make available the types of facilities that are seen in modern camps throughout New Zealand and indeed around the world. Mr. Burden in particular As you will also, I think, be aware, there has been a proposal for, in terms of part two of the PDP review, to have an underlying zoning over simply the council owned land as community open space, I think it's called.
Community purpose zone.
Okay. And we have suggested that, frankly, during our submissions and in our appeal against the decision to so zone that land, that it's unusual that a zoning would relate to ownership, but for whatever reason, that has been the decision of the council and the commission to date to so zone the council owned land. What we're trying to get here is a zoning which is consistent over all of the land which the Verdon see as having potential for the expansion of the camp in the future. Nothing will change in terms of that part of that land will be owned by the council and part of that land will be owned privately by the council. So I've prepared some opening legal submissions which I assume you've had the opportunity
to. Yes, thank you, Mr.
So I'm happy to answer your questions. Then I intend to call Mr. and Mrs. Burden, Mr. Espy and Mr. White, who are each of whom have prepared summaries of their evidence.
Well, I don't have any issues, any questions for you, Mr. Cogden.
No, no questions. All good, thank you, sir. Thank
you. All clear, and so I'd like to hear from your witnesses.
Yes, could I call Mrs. Burden?
Mrs. Burden, please.
Good morning.
Just carry on, read your summary, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. Richard and I bought the lease for the camp from the Cotter family in 2009, and we have 17 years remaining on our lease, and we also own the land adjoining the camp. Sustainability is the key element to all our operations so that we can continue to operate in the future. And we must continuously adapt and make changes, which often includes diversifying our businesses. The district plan is an important part of this process and we appreciate being able to submit on it accordingly. The zoning and the district plan to us is all about planning and the resource consent process is all about following the rules that relate to the plan. We want to be able to plan now and in the future. However, Rural General ONL does not allow us to do this effectively or efficiently like the Rural Visitor Zone does. The piece of land in question is encompassed by State Highway 6 and Lake Howie, we are making it a parcel of land. It takes up approximately 0.007% of the lakefront of Lake Howie. Currently, the leased area, referred to as the camp, already offers visitor accommodation as it has done for nearly 50 years, operating as a holiday park. The current lease, although outdated, encourages further development of accommodation and the camp is designated as motor park and allows building coverage of 40% of the total site. That's 15 hectares, and that excludes the play equipment. The current open space rules allows for building as a restricted discretionary activity. The Rural Visitor Zone's purpose is to provide visitor accommodation. In that zone, the following are permitted activities: visitor accommodation, commercial recreation activities, and on-site staff accommodation, recreation and recreation activity. The extension of visitor accommodation onto the private land is relative to the sustainability of the operation and hence existence in the future. We believe that this is the best use of the land in the future. Visitor accommodation and accompanying activities, as this not only complements the existing land, but the Rural Visitor Zone provides continuity and consistency over the whole parcel of land. It is important to have consistency so that we can plan and do our developments in stages as we can afford. The planners initially rejected rural visitor zone in stage one, stating that the rural general ONL zone is more suitable for the private land. But we totally disagree, and we know because we are the ones that have to follow the process. We have found the rural general zone to be a deterrent due to the stress alone. It's baffling, let alone the cost associated and the time delays. Consent is not guaranteed, which makes it incredibly hard to plan long term with regards to infrastructure, services, and especially acquiring funding. The planning costs are exorbitant and the stress of wasting money, which could be spent on the actual buildings and the landscape itself. I told Richard that I couldn't go through the resource consent process in rural general ONL again. We were committed to a process that didn't guarantee consent, making it very high risk, and the conditions put on us were not in line with us operating a holiday park that had existed for nearly 50 years. Even introducing glamping into the camping ground under rural general and ONL rules has been a nightmare. Open space zoning allows for future development of the camp, but it doesn't allow us to do this on private land. The continuation of rural visitor zone across the whole area makes sense. It is not only complementary to what is already there, but rather than having two zones, two sets of rules, and the same purpose, it is simplified into one zone. This not only prevents confusion, making it very clear for planning, but it endorses visitor accommodation over the whole piece and allows planning to occur in stages. We have over 200 camping sites and we have concerns because our facilities are old. We have the added pressure to ensure that camping remains affordable and whether camping is actually going to cut it in the future with free camps continuing to evolve. To be sustainable, the camp will rely on adding more high yield accommodation available all round into the mix. Unfortunately, it is not viable for us to put this directly onto the council land. Therefore, the rural visitor zone is extremely important to ensure camping continues and it remains operational and successful in the future. There is no doubt that the 22 hectares can absorb 7% of building coverage. By walking around the camp, extra accommodation is not going to have a negative impact on what is there now. In fact, we see it as having a positive impact in many ways. Increased employment, increased occupancy. We can accommodate more people in the Lake Hauwea region. Collaboration with community and other businesses. Provision of accommodation available all year round, not just the summer months. Stability of cash flow, jobs, continual investment in the region. Establishment of high yield, high quality accommodation, which is needed to be sustainable. Increase of facilities. Ongoing landscaping, mitigating visual effects of buildings and enhancing the park-like values. We believe the rural visitor zone is ideal compared to the rural general zone ONL. Rural general ONL does not help us to take on new opportunities. We have actually classified it as a threat to our business, a deterrent. It doesn't give us an opportunity to plan and move with the times. Rural visitor zone is ideal for planning in stages and ensures that the long-term big picture vision is feasible. Because the rural general zone is not specific to visitor accommodation, it doesn't encourage accommodation development like rural visitor zone does. The rural visitor zone provides us with confidence to continue to develop further accommodation and facilities to be enjoyed by visitors and locals to our region. Rural general ONL, with the additional stress and costs, make it harder for us to make a return. The rural visitor zone alleviates these costs and stress immediately and is the more sustainable option. We need to develop high yield accommodation available all year round to support the camp's future. In rural general ONL, consent is not guaranteed, so neither is the camp's future. Developing in ONL is extremely difficult and repetitive. Every time you apply for resource consent in rural general, you face the same issues over and over again, and the same costs. We have to continuously justify why accommodation is suited to the land and why we should be able to put accommodation in ONL. In times like COVID-19, planning is essential to be able to adapt and change with future direction. Prior to COVID-19, the demand for the camp was increasing exponentially, and we expect that this will resume as the demand will continue with the increase in domestic travellers and once the borders open again. There is a definite demand for visitor accommodation, and the district plan zoning ensures that there are opportunities to be able to meet demand. We believe that the accommodation is the best use for the land and that rural visitor zone is the best zone for the land. We are asking the Council to support the Lake Halweir Rural Visitor Zone so that we can continue to commit and invest and support the tourism industry by continuing to add a range of accommodation in the Lake Halweir region away from the busy centres so that people can experience and enjoy the outdoors now and for future generations to come.
Thank you, Mrs. Burden. I have an immediate question. When I read your evidence, the impression I had of your vision, and of course I've heard you speak on this before, so sort of overlaying, I'm trying to remember what you previously told me, the impression I have is that you're looking to move away from the 1950s Kiwi camping experience to something that is more of an international focus, but the sort of the pricey that Mr. Todd gave me suggested it wasn't so much international but just a general upgrading. So where is it in that spectrum? Are you looking to do something different, or are you looking to do it better, or something in between?
Yeah, we're looking at doing obviously better. We've got a vision that we've put together, and obviously that continues to change. But our vision is to put in clusters of accommodation, which you've already started with the glamping, and to extend that into more self-contained accommodation. So as you can see in the holiday park, we're trying to put in these geodesic domes. They're our first type of accommodation that is like a glamorous accommodation that has self-contained facilities so that it can be used all year round. The focus, I'm very much into ecotourism, so the focus is really about accommodating and forming areas that we can gather people. And so I'm not looking at putting in high-rise resort type facilities, but we would tend to be moving to create facilities that make the camping ground a destination so that people can stay in the facility and be accommodated for their week's holiday and use it as a base, so they can travel around the area and come back at night time and have meals and be able, or camping, etc. Is that answering your question?
Yes, thank you.
That's the other thing, is we have a very high domestic. We still have, it's probably about 60% is our domestic market, and we want to continue to encourage camping. I mean, the good thing about the glamping and being able to provide more facilities is that we can accommodate people outside of those summer periods, and that's the main point, is that at the moment, no one wants to go to the loo when it's freezing cold, because it's just not fun, is it? But if they've got accommodation, they can still come and stay in the camping ground and enjoy what it is and use it as a base. And as everything, we want to try and encourage people to stay more than a night experience. We want to stay 3 to 5 days. At the moment, our domestic campers stay sort of between 5 and 7 over the summer, which is fantastic, and that's what also makes it sustainable. We can put packages together that people can stay for 3 days and do the lake, can do Wanaka, can tour the area. It's an awesome place to base, but it's about turning it into a destination that we can facilitate different activities and accommodate different people.
Commissioner Hill.
And the big thing about that, Commissioner, is that for me, the camping ground needs to be able to have different groups of people from different affordabilities. So that's what we're doing at the moment, is we've got the camping, but just because you're camping doesn't mean that you can't go and do you know, mix with other people. So it's about bringing people together, like-minded people who enjoy the outdoors. Some people don't like camping.
Yeah.
They need a bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
But they still want to mix with people. And their camping is having a bathroom.
A couple of contextual questions. I mean, in your evidence and summary, you talk about that the lease encourages additional accommodation. Is that, how specific is that, or is your vision aligned to that? Are you required to provide more, or just simply an encouragement?
The lease is old, so it's encouraging to put more cabins in. But if you have a look at what the definition of a holiday park is, a holiday park is actually not just your Kiwi camping Kiwi camping ground. It actually has a range of accommodation, and as with a lot of alignment with other holiday parks, they offer motels, apartments, cottages, houses, a whole range. So with that in respect, what was the question?
No, that was fine. So when we did our site visit, there were some platforms that looked like decks or something being built. What is that? Where the domes?
They're glamping tents.
Oh, those are glamping.
Oh, what are you talking about? When did you go?
A month ago.
Oh yeah. So they're the that's the domes. So that's the geodesic domes.
Right.
So they're sort of like high end glamping,
yeah, right.
And they've got their own bathrooms.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
And that's what they are. Yes.
Right. That's good. Thank you.
So we envisage putting more of those in, but we also envisage putting cottagey sort of, alpiney cottage accommodation in, so people can come and stay for a week and have their own kitchen facilities. I mean, a lot of people, like, when they come to a holiday park, are on a budget, and if they can cook and do things like that, they might have a night out at the food truck, but a lot of the times they'll bring their own food and everything with them.
And I assume the domes, they're permanent structures, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. No, that's good. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And the council were really supportive of...
That.
Yep, they've been really supportive of any of development throughout the camping ground. Mm-hmm. And but from our point of view, it's cost is exorbitant. Yeah. Yeah.
That's come through very clearly in the evidence. Thank you, Mr.
Yep.
Chairman.
Commissioner Dawson.
Thank you. Just on the same theme, the northern area that's sort of not separated by the contact land, why do you want to include that land? What's your
vision? Probably more on an eco aspect, to be able to put some probably more glamping sort of type thing, probably not so permanent, still permanent for accommodation, but probably more of an ecotourism-y type effect.
Just another option for another form of accommodation.
Yeah. What we're trying to achieve in the holiday park, I suppose, is that is clusters of different types of accommodation. So groups can come in and camp together, or individuals can also camp, but they're like-minded. So what we're finding with the glamping is people are just loving it, and they're being able to... We've put them in clusters, so we've got a group of five tents, and a little community, a little area where they can make tea and coffee. And what they do is they all collaborate together. If there's individuals, they meet each other, so it's really lovely. So the whole thing is about having different types of accommodation throughout the camping ground. And for that area down there, that would be more an eco-tourism-y sort of development, and it might be off the grid a bit more, a little bit sort of, you know, and the whole thing is about fitting things in with the environment, not putting something out there that's not going to fit with the environment. But it gives people, some people want to be a little bit more isolated from other people, so that means that a group can go out there and there's not so many people, they have an amazing experience, but they can also go into the campground and use the other facilities. And we find that with the glamping tents. Sometimes they'll go and join in and do the food truck. Mm-hmm. Other times they want to just be with themselves.
You said in your summary that, that a camp currently allows for a building coverage of 40% of the total size.
That's the motor park designation.
Okay.
So we've got a designation that covers the whole of the motor park, you know, the whole of the area. The whole of the council area is designated motor park. And that allows buildings up to 8.58 metres as well, so two-storey buildings and at 40% coverage.
So at the moment, well, if the PDP comes into play, I know I'm subject to your opinion, but say if the zoning under the PDP came into play, the land would be both a camping ground, informal recreation, camping, or whatever zoning, as well as a designation.
The designation I remains with the land. The designation stays with the land.
Yes.
Yeah. So with regards to the zoning, yes, we are proposing to only put 7%. So it's actually less than the 40%.
That's in your rural visitor zone. I'm just trying to understand the current situation.
Oh, sorry, the current situation.
We can put
40%
under our designation. But you couldn't put 40% under the informal camping zone. I think it's sort of 600 metres maximum coverage for the whole site.
I can cover that.
Is that, yes. All right, but it's the designation that you're referring to.
Yes, that's correct. So when we purchased the lease, that's what we were under the impression, 40% building could be utilised.
And that would override the zone while the designation remains in place. Okay, so those are a couple of specific questions. Now, I'm just trying to get a feel for the sorts of provisions that might apply within a rural visitor zone. Because not only, on the one hand, I understand why you're asking for a rural visitor zone. I mean, I think we've heard that from you, and we know that you see that as much more efficient and representative of what you want to do. But within that zone, you are still wanting to protect the tree landscape. Your vision for it is to still have a relatively tree landscape within the overall zone.
The camp's got a park-like atmosphere.
Yes.
People love it. And we've got beautiful colour. In the summer we get the shade, and in the winter we get the leaves drop. So, yes. That's what a lot of people come to the camp for, because it's a beautiful camp with those. That's what we're intending to keep in there.
Yes.
There is, though, that when you're camping, certain trees and things like that aren't suitable in the camping ground. And sometimes, like putting in just natives everywhere is not the best use for camping under, or, you know, they bush up and then you lose your camping areas and things like that. So in order to landscape it, we landscape it with the intention that people are camping in mind. The buildings and things, it's the same thing. People still want that open space when they're in a camping ground, and I think that's why it is important not to have the whole area absolutely chock-a-block with trees. But, you know, with regards to mitigating buildings and things like that, I don't see it a problem. I mean, we stood back on that private land, and you've got, you know, so many metres of different levels of trees. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like there was the building and it was empty. There was trees everywhere. So we would continue on with that.
And
that's
like
part of the character.
We walked up towards the road, but of course you can't actually get to the road because you've got that tree boundary.
Yeah. Did you drive up there? Because if you drive up there and sit on the gravel pit and you look down, the trees are actually 20 metres high,
so
30 metres high.
To keep a strip of trees along that road boundary, and actually the lake boundary, your boundary is back from the lake anyway, isn't it? So there's a strip of trees along there that...
Yeah, but the other thing is also that our customers also want to see the lake. So, I mean, that's part of being on the lakefront, is being able to see the lake. We're not encouraged... I mean, there's some... beachfront areas that we wouldn't even build on, because it would affect the visual, you know, the community areas in the camping ground. There's not a hell of a lot of lakefront. It's not like Glendu, where everyone has a view. There's only partial areas of a view. But it's important for our campers to be able to see the lake from the campground.
Okay.
if you're a visitor and you came and stayed at a lakefront campground, you'd hope that you saw the lake.
You could walk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you mean from their tent?
No, not necessarily from their tent, but they, you know, they still want to be able to see the lake.
Can I suggest that the intent of the tent is to be almost remote, so, but still being able to access open space, the lake, views, etc., etc., so you actually feel removed from the world in a camping environment?
Yeah.
Is that the vision? That's the sort of thing you're envisioning?
Yeah. So we promote ourselves as the your quintessential Kiwi camping experience. So that's what we're going to, and beautifully basic. And that's our intention. I mean, I can send you some information of our story and what we're trying to achieve. But at the end of the day, we want people to be able to come out to the campground, still experience camping, but we also want them to have that option that they can stay in accommodation and they can stay all year round and still have that same sort of experience, that they still can go outside and see the stars, they can still go out and hear the birds. You know, I mean, we have beautiful bird life out in that park, and we're so close to walking tracks and to the biking tracks. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing little position, and it's easy walking to town. So, yeah, for us, it's creating the outdoors. I mean, the activities that we want to put in there are more outdoor cooking, people experiencing, you know, I mean, it's exactly a camping ground experience. Even if you're staying in a cottage, you still get that same experience.
Can I want to just ask you, and I'll probably ask everybody this, so don't feel I'm taking on you to ask this.
No, it's fine.
We've got this zone, the rural businesses zone,
yeah,
which is what it is. It can be amended, of course, and lots of people are asking for lots of different amendments to this zone, as you are, your submission is. But one of the things that is a particular focus of the way it was notified is it's for remote areas,
mm-hmm,
that are difficult to see from public places. And I just want your perception, I suppose, of
remote,
those aspects of,
yeah,
remoteness and difficult to see for your site.
Okay, so, I mean, I live out at Lake Hawea, and from my point of view, I think it's remote in itself. It's away from the main centres. So from my point of view, it is a remote location. From the camping ground, with having the township that close, it is still remote from the township. I mean, if you're in the camping ground, you do not feel like you are in near any township. And I think that's probably the beauty of it, is that you can... I think with rural visitor zone, from my point of view, what rural visitor zone really tries to achieve is it's about getting people out of the centres, out of the cities, and being able to go into areas to experience outdoors sort of type thing. So it's not remote as in climbing up to the top of a spire, but it is remote for a lot of people that live in a city, live in Auckland, live in Queenstown even, to come out to Hawea, and it's remote in that respect. So if you're looking for a piece of land that is isolated from existence, then it's not isolated, but it is remote. And the next town from that lake is Makarora, and have a look at it. You know, that's what you know, Lake Hawea is growing, but you know, things are going to continue to grow. Makarora, you know, might not be remote in the future in respect to being a town, but it is at the moment. And Lake Hawea, from my perspective, that piece of land is remote from Hawea itself.
Because, I mean, one of the reasons, I'm just making an assumption here, that the zone is provided for in remote areas,
yeah,
is that you can't easily just go and camp in town. And for example, in Wanaka, some of the camping grounds are really in the town. They're not in the main, they're not isolated. But in your case, you're saying you're not in the town.
No, we're isolated from
the urban camping area and don't intend to be.
No.
You might be a long way physically, but you're separated.
When you go out to the camping ground, you'll notice that we're not a concrete jungle. We don't have concrete everywhere where people park their vans and things. We're a park-like setting. And that's what is special about it, and that's what we intend to retain. So we're not intending it to be a built-up, you know. But what you've also got to understand is that there is 22 hectares. There is room to put development in there, and there is room to put clusters of accommodation, and we can only do that as we can see fit. And with the council land, they still have to approve if we put any buildings on that land anyway. So I think you've also got quite a good protection there. I don't feel that there's no intention to build on the flat land where we have the campus. I mean, I probably didn't make that very clear, but there's only a certain amount of flat land in that camping ground, and our intention is not to build on that flat land where we've got the campers.
But the rules wouldn't prevent you from doing that.
The rules wouldn't prevent us from doing that, no.
I mean, I can't remember how many 500 square metre buildings they said there could
31.
Be.
31.
But you've got to remember that on that flat land, the council still has to give us approval as a leasee to put it on that land.
Yeah, so it's a matter of how much we have that as the controlling entity, or the zone is the additional.
I think we're suggesting it's both.
Well, it is at the moment, yeah. But in the zone, you could put 30,500 square metre buildings on the flat.
Yes, I don't think I could afford to do that. But
why do you want it then?
Why do I want rural visitor zone?
Why do you want 31,500 square metres?
I'm not saying we want 31. You're saying why do we want 31?
Yeah.
So
you are by saying 7% building coverage as your controlling rule.
Over a period of time, yeah, it could take 50 years to do that. And that you'd only do that if demand encouraged it. And at the moment, demand does not encourage it. We've had that holiday park for 10 years, and it was only in the last 2 years that we felt that we could actually put some more accommodation in there, as we it was affordable, but that it was actually going to be in the demand area. So it does run on demand and supply.
But
I'm looking really long term. I mean, that's the whole point of having a zone, is so that we can plan for the long term, because the infrastructure and facilities, say for example the sewerage, we need to be able to plan a system that can accommodate. And if we're looking at putting more buildings in and it's gradual, then we also have to look at those systems and things to accommodate it. So we are restricted in some areas of what we can build and how many, and that will depend on the sewerage and things like that. But until we've got the zoning, we need to be able to plan that and then put that into place. Without that zoning, it's probably unaffordable for us to even go there at the moment.
And the final question is, in terms of visibility from public places, it talks about, you've put forward a building restriction area and planting along the state highway, so that's clear. From the lake shore at the township or in the township, what provisions are there to limit visibility into the camp from that side?
I think when you have a look from the township, there's a couple of things there. It's when you're looking straight out like we are here on that map, it's the main focal point of when people are looking out from the lakefront is looking straight. Yeah, it's not looking left going da da da. The other thing is also there's always been a camping ground there for 50 years, so people are used to seeing some buildings there. And they're also used to, when people camp their camper vans right on the lakefront, they're used to seeing some camper vans. So we don't prevent people from parking on the lakefront if they want to park their camper van on the lakefront. They can be seen from the shore. In the prior to the existence of the camping ground, there weren't any trees shielding that area at all. But it's always been, like if you speak to Jerry Burden, it was always earmarked for a camping ground. So there was always going to have a visual aspect of that, that you would be able to see the camping ground. The trees do, like we put the glamping sites in, and if you went to the, we put the 5 glamping sites that were quite close to the lakefront, and if you went to the town centre and had a look, you can't see those glamping tents. You know, so we're talking about buildings that are going to be set back. A lot of them are going to be set back. And there's 9, 10 layers of trees in front of them that are already in the campground, existing in the campground now, which prevents you from seeing those buildings.
Okay. All right, that's all my questions. Thank you.
Is that all?
Yeah, just... I tried to find crosshill.com and it took me to a financial advisory group.
Oh, it's crosshill.co.nz.
There you go. That's what I thought it was. I actually did type that in and got there in the end.
Yeah.
Which is a great website. one other question, which hasn't already been asked. Under the RVZ, the rural visitor zone.
Yes.
Informal airports are permitted.
Sorry?
Informal airports are a permitted activity.
Informal airports?
Yes. As in,
right.
And just with an eye to the... Was that something you envisage happening on?
Putting an airport in?
Well, it talks about 15 flights a week. So is this something that would happen?
What sort of planes are you talking about?
Could be choppers.
I would imagine it would be helicopter, because I couldn't imagine a plane, unless it was a seaplane.
Oh.
Couldn't imagine a terrace either.
I haven't really thought about that.
What's
that, I mean, there could be people that might want to arrive by helicopter, and we have got land that's private land that they could arrive by helicopter as if now.
Yep.
Is that, I'd say?
So
it's not our intention to have helicopters buzzing in and out, but
no.
Some people do like to do activities that might require a helicopter or a wedding or something. I'm not sure.
A hunting trip or something.
Most of our hunters that we have staying with us do not catch a helicopter from the campground. They go, because the hunters do stay at the camp. We take them into town and they fly out from there.
Or from Tarras.
The
other, when we went to the site visit, went up to the Crownland, drove up to the Crownland segment and walked up to that Crownland
yes.
segment. And there's a road that comes, like it's a four-wheel drive track, that
mm-hmm.
comes back adjacent to the road.
Oh, yeah, the road behind, yes.
Yes, behind. I walked up and down that. Is that sort of where you're envisaging the
buffer?
Because it's quite steep up to the road.
Exactly, it's really steep, so there's no buildings going to be going on, and that's the buffer zone, really, between the road and the road.
Even though on the map there's a 15-metre line, it's probably more logically going to follow where that steep bank is, and that's the planting that you're talking about.
Yeah, which is already, planted, really, already now, but we're talking about, as time progresses, is probably putting it more into a native rather than the what's presently there now. We've already got a good buffer. Do you know what I mean? You actually can't see because of the topography in the camping ground, and that you have got that huge bank. You can't even see from right back. So you can't even see the power lines of the road. So if you can't see the power lines, then they can't see you either from the road. That makes sense.
Much like
the topography, I think, is one of the biggest benefits of this whole thing, is that it can absorb buildings in there without being able to see them from the road or from the lake. But the other thing is also it is a camping ground, so you do expect to see some buildings, but during the summer months you hardly see them because of the trees. It's only just really in the winter or the autumn that you might see visions of, you know, specks of them. It's also only a point, like I said, it's 0.07% of the lake frontage that we're talking about. We're not talking about a massive area.
I think it was 0.007.
0.8, like 007.
Yeah. 0.007. Much like Mr. White, I'm addicted to cycling a bicycle, and I go along there quite regularly, and you rarely see the campground, I would agree. The only other thing is just looking at perspective from the lake. And we discussed alluded earlier to the camp sites being quite remote. You mentioned about a view to the lake. That's just view shafts that are there, or is that what your perceiving perception is?
What do you mean?
Well, rather than having a glamping tent, which is you watch the sunrise on the lake, it would be would that be remote from the lake?
There's potential to put more. I mean, in some of that area, is it? I'm sorry, a bit confused about what your question is.
The location of the glamping sites. So, for example, say up in this top section.
Yeah.
And you said that's a glamping site.
Yeah, that would be a really good glamping area.
Is the intention for them to have full views over the lake?
It would be intention for them to have views of the lake, yeah. But you've also got to remember that quite often with glamping tents and things like that, it doesn't mean that you've got a little window. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, and you can still plant around that to mitigate those effects of people being able to see in. But I tell you what, when you're travelling along that lake, it is absolutely gorgeous seeing a few glamping tents and things along the lake. It's actually, you know, you're going past a camping ground and seeing a few tents doesn't hurt anyone. It actually, people love it. It actually adds a bit of character to the area.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you, Mrs. Burden. Can I hear from Mr. Espy next?
No, I'm going to hear from Mr. Burden.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Burden.
Yes.
Ah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. just a quick discussion following up from Callan's about the trees. And there are strong clusters of pine trees and on both what we call Windsurfer Bay, which is the bottom end, and in the middle of the park, and the top end of the park, which are on sort of rocky and pretty hard to develop areas, and our long-term aim is to maintain those areas of clusters, because as you know, Hawea is actually quite a windy lake, and it's important for us to keep that lakefront, those trees there, to act as buffers, and yes, view corridors out to the lake is what we're trying to maintain. So we're very keen to maintain that park-like setting, the view corridors going down, and the park-like setting, which is how the park is pretty structured at the moment. The Lake Hawea Holiday Park, known as the Camp, is a perfect fit for the Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zone. There is limited land zoned in Hawea for visitor accommodation, and we're talking about for the next 10 to 15 years, yet it is one of the fastest growing towns in this district. My grandfather, George Burden, farmed the land which today is the camp. He'd be very proud to know the Burden family are owners of the camp lease, because in 1959, Lake Hawea was raised by 20 metres, and then less than a kilometre away from the camp, a storage dam was built. My grandfather lost 320 hectares of productive low-lying land, valuable front country, which in the time was taken under the Public Works Act. It was not an ideal outcome for him and at that time. A new realigned road was constructed through the property, leaving us with a strip of marginal lakefront land that for the last 10 years we've been trying to incorporate part of the same into the camp. It even has its own separate titles. It has very little farming value, separate titles and is a natural fit with the camp. Common sense should prevail, as this is the Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zone, all but in name. The Hawea resident in me questions why the land questionable identified as outstanding natural landscape cannot accommodate an appropriately developed rural visitor zone. There is a strong underlying common sense to allow this marginal and highly modified land to be zoned for the enjoyment and betterment of the public and to provide economic use, employment whilst maintaining the environmental integrity of the immediate area. In my practical eyes, and the reality of it, is that Lake Hawea is a highly modified hydro storage lake with a large concrete dam, a heavily eroded shoreline, with large numbers of pines and Douglas fir and other exotics planted in and around the existing commercial camping ground, planted by the Public Works Department to shield a Public Works eyesore. The drowned front country, the destruction of the natural landforms that provide valuable shelter to the lake users, are the scars of ongoing lakeshore erosion can be mitigated not only through time but also through allowing people to enjoy the area and place a higher value on it through sharing it with the public in a sustainable and attractive way. A visitor zone goes quite some distance towards restoring enjoyment of use and recreational values. This is our third submission lodged over three stages of the district plan review. The process has meant that the issues of the zoning in the campground and surrounding sites have been spread out over three hearings with Queenstown Lakes District Council, inviting submissions at each stage. At all three stages, we've enjoyed the support of the Hawea community, and we've consulted with it throughout a protracted process. We will continue to seek Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zone, and it's encouraging to see that Landscapers Planners report are being positive in this regard. I feel it's important to point out to the commissioners that as lessees of the council, we still need the council's sign-off and approval of just about everything we do in the camp, and that's include removing the trees. And so we've had quite a bit of discussion today about that you could build a 500 square metre house here and you could do this. Well, we can't really, because we actually need, you know, we're working with the council, we actually need their approval. And at the moment, to cut down a gum tree, which we believe is a health and safety hazard, it's taken us 2 years to negotiate the rights to cut down a tree that's causing us quite a bit of grief. And so you can imagine how difficult it would be to cut down a tree to put out more accommodation there. So we do need to work, we are lessees, we do need to work with the council, and those protections are already in place. Glendine is an internationally recognised business with a gold quail mark. It provides accommodation, goods and services, and generates revenue for New Zealand and the district. We're sizeable employers in the district, our staff are important to us, and we wish to create new opportunities through the Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zone. There is no reason not to support this change and assist in creating a vibrant and sustainable community. Not allowing for the rezoning is not planning for the future. We're allowing for a vibrant and sustainable future. We all understand the enormous growth and we have experienced through the district and how much Lake Hawea Township has grown. Growth and demand has been incredible, and we've all known we're already at the projected 10-year population plan numbers already. Just the sheer number in tourists that were in New Zealand pre-COVID 19 and the inability of the community to accommodate the demand is testament into the fact that we need more visitor accommodation in areas outside the crowded townships. And that where we fit quite nicely into that remoteness of the district, and we talk about remoteness being at Lake Hawea, I think that's why it's also another perfect fit, because our townships have become overcrowded in many ways, especially with some of these freedom campers. So post-COVID, I see New Zealand being a destination and a haven that people from all over the world will want to flock to. I also feel it's important to point out, from a sound commercial perspective, investors and financiers will be reluctant to bank developments on freehold or leasehold land without appropriate zonings being in place. There is simply too much uncertainty in having to continuously seek consents. Banks now require a high level of security, and as well as we all know, having to go through the RMA process is very difficult and a costly process. It is important to us to have Lake Hawea rural visitor zoning in place across the freehold and the camp so that we can, and future generations, are able to proceed to finish building the geodesic domes project and undertake further development as the demand grows. To put it in perspective even more clearly, banks will not lend more than 50% of the value of the lease. This really limits what we're able to achieve with the current zoning. We have been personally and mentally drained by this lengthy and expensive process to date. We have spent over $230,000 in the camp and freehold land on resource consents, planning, reporting in the last 4 years. This includes our geodesic dome and glamping developments. All this is prior to getting a post in the ground. Both our parents and many business people felt this was horrendous, and on more than one occasion advised us to stop. Sarah and I have not stopped because we have created a camp that we see people from New Zealand and all over the world enjoying. We have a clear long-term vision for the camp. We want to make it sustainable, eco-friendly, and a great asset for this district. I can speak with confidence in that our team of professional advisors would not support us if they did not believe in what we have proposed for the Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zone. The zone change and the conditions we seek are right for this area. There are some of the most respected professional advisors that live and work in this district, and all have long-term credibility as planners and advisors. We have invested an enormous amount of time and energy into creating a great camp. The glamping areas, the renovated cottages, the safari tent, the recreational domes, the Crosshill Lodge and accommodation domes, the food truck, upgrading power sites, water, the landscaping are all contributing to the wonderful camping experience. And just to dwell a wee bit, so you can understand, you know, because this vegetation thing seems to be quite an important thing. When we first went there, there were stumps and gum trees, and we've really developed that whole landscape, and it is now an amazing park-like setting, and we're very proud of what we've achieved with the landscaping in the camp. And it's an important aspect, you know, and we love the bird life and the planting, and we want to continue to enhance that, and we spend quite a lot of money every year on the council's trees to improve those. People value the quiet enjoyment, the open space camping, park-like settings we offer at the camp. Children run freely, people can relax and enjoy a lakeside holiday. This is an important step for Lake Hawea, but we need your support with the Lake Hawea Rural Visitor Zoning so that we can achieve good long-term planning outcomes. We're able to make the changes required to become sustainable, eco-friendly, and most of all, remain a great camp. Thank you for your time and your incredible energy working through this district plan.
So the energy's waning after the day 15. Mr. Hill.
I think it's very clear what you're asking, thank you.
No, I think you've answered some of the questions you went along.
It seemed to me that the peer review of the invest, and I think clarifying that vision was well done.
Thank you.
So
Thank you very much, Mr. Burden. Appreciate that. Thank you. Mrs. Burden went first. She got all the questions. There's a cutting plan, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. So I'll read through this summary and then happy to take any questions or discussion.
Absolutely, please proceed.
The relief sought has been amended since the time of the submission. Development enabled by the sought area of rural visitor zone will be very considerably less dense than that of other rural visitor zones and will be subject to a number of controls. Specifically, the relief now includes buildings being at least a controlled activity, with matters of control including landform modification, landscaping, the compatibility of building design with landscape and visual amenity. Maximum total coverage of 7%, as we've talked about this morning. A variable allowable building height for buildings within the area of rural visitor zone. A state highway buffer area that we've heard a bit about, immediately adjacent to State Highway 6, with specific provisions relating to its vegetative management. The proposed rural visitor zone will sit close to, but distinct from, Hawea Township and will take in the existing commercial motor camp. Nonetheless, it is within a broader mountains and lakes ONL that is characterised by vastness, openness, generally unmodified character and dramatic aesthetics. Due to the existing modification within the submission site and it being adjacent to Hawea Township, the specific location of the proposed rural visitor zone does not particularly contribute to the important landscape character qualities that make Lake Hawea landscape an ONL. In terms of landscape character, the site is a location with potential to absorb some change, more so than most locations within this landscape, or almost all locations, you could probably say. In relation to landscape character, the existing modification and occupation and the immediate proximity to Hawea Township mean that this specific location is different to the vast majority of land adjacent to Lake Hawea, which is generally open, unoccupied, and largely unmodified. Now, as we've heard, of course, the lake itself has been raised, and so the shoreline is not the natural shoreline, and the degree of modification around the lake is an extensive agricultural level of modification, if you like. So again, it's certainly not pristine, but it's a level of modification you'd expect to see in an ONL in this district. The extension of visitor accommodation activities that the proposed rural visitor zone represents will not significantly detract from the important landscape character qualities that make Lake Hawea landscape an ONL. In relation to views and visual amenity, the state highway buffer area and associated provisions will mean that the visual amenity of a highway user very much continues to be dominated by the lake and mountains. While some additional development will be discernible over and above the currently visible visitor activity, it will generally be below the important lines of sight to the broader landscape and or will be very significantly screened by vegetation. A highway user will continue to experience the stretch of highway adjacent to the site as a stretch that is close to a town and somewhat different to the remainder of the highway as it adjoins Lake Hawea, which allows completely uninterrupted views to a vast open lake surface. Visual amenity will not be detracted from to any significant degree. In views from the east, from the lake that is, and from Hawea Township and the shore, an intensification of existing visitor occupation activity will be evident. However, this will be in an area that currently accommodates visible activity at times of year very apparent, and will be of a low density that involves significant open space and existing vegetation. Development that will ultimately occur will appear logical, tied to existing development and Hawea Township, and not visually unattractive. The composition of views that are currently available will not fundamentally change or be degraded. Mrs. Gilbert, who is the council reporting landscape staff, sir, Ms. Gilbert raises some concerns regarding potential significant tree removal and buildings that are prominently visible adjacent to the lake edge. It must be borne in mind that the vast majority of the proposed area of rural visitor zone is council-owned land. That's that 15-hectare block. This council-owned block is relatively densely treed in mixed and park-like trees and takes in most of the lake edge of the proposed rural visitor zone, which is still separated from the lake itself by Lynn's land. So there's a strip of Lynn's land outside of the proposed rural visitor zone, outside of the council block, which is the lake edge itself. I understand that the existing designation provides for 40% building coverage of the council-owned block, and that development provided for by this designation would form part of the maximum 7% coverage that is now proposed across the entire rural visitor zone. However, the council as owner must approve of any development, and more importantly, any removal of trees on this land, and this will continue to be the case if the proposed relief is granted. I understand that the council is very protective of the trees and open space on this land. I consider that despite the lease that exists, the community can have faith that the council will manage its land appropriately in accordance with community interests, and that development, including any tree removal, up to the maximum provided for by the proposed relief, will be done in a responsible way that properly deals with landscape and visual effects. In my understanding, the submitter requests the proposed zoning in order to future-proof their operation, and we've heard about this, rather to undertake any significant development in the short term. Development within the existing camp operation has been incremental over many years, and I understand that this is intended to continue. It may be years or decades before a 7% site coverage is approached. If we envisage the district plan providing for visitor growth within the district for at least a decade once operative, or more likely double that, I consider that in relation to landscape planning considerations, the relief sought is appropriate. It will expand an existing operation that sits in a logical and appropriate location.
Thank you, Mr. Espy. I have a few questions to kick off. My colleagues warm up.
I think the point
Ms. Gilbert makes about your suggested buffer is the inherent arbitrariness of a standard set off or setback. And the point we observe when we're on the site is that there are areas where, as Mrs. Burton observed, you can stand on the edge of the grassed area and you can look up at a steep bank. You can't see the power lines. The road's a long way above you, and I can envisage that a 15-metre setback would be perfectly adequate. But there are also areas where the difference in elevation is not nearly so great, where you can stand on the grass and you can see the power poles, which, as Mrs. Burton observes, are the clearest indication of where the road is, and you could envisage somebody looking straight in. So that's a long way of saying, is 15 metres arbitrary? Does it need to be matched to the topography, that it might be less than that in some places and more than that in others to reflect the topography?
Well, it could be. The 20 metre setback...
Oh, sorry, it's 20.
The 20 metre setback is from the road corridor boundary, which is actually quite, in many places, is quite distant from the road formation. So there's quite an area inside the road corridor that is already a separator, And then from the road corridor boundary down into the site, we've got this 20 metre buffer. There are provisions proposed, and I believe policy even, Mr. White will tell you about that, about the treatment of that 20 metre buffer. And without going to the wording of that, it really provides for incremental revegetation of that buffer, favouring native species. It's very largely covered in sycamore at the moment. Well, it's a mix, but there's a lot of sycamore. Incremental revegetation of that using native species that, in fullness of time, will replace the sycamore, if you like. So even on an area where there is not so much altitude separation, a 20 metre wide buffer that is heavily vegetated is going to create a significant buffer visually. So I'm not so worried about the topography issue. And of course, as well as that 20 metre buffer, as we've heard, all of the council owned block is quite heavily treed, and to remove any trees and replace them with buildings or to do anything like that requires the council's approval and the council's cooperation. So even outside of that 20 metre buffer, there's going to be plenty of trees. There's not going to be some sort of hard line where trees stop. That can't happen without the council's approval. So, in addition to that, we have the controlled activity status that includes landscaping and earthworks and so on. So I would expect under a controlled activity application to do some development inside this zone. I mean, we go through these processes a lot. The council's not shy of using its control to get landscaping right. So I'd expect that to happen as well. So I guess because of all those factors, I ended up being comfortable with a 20 metre wide strip. You're right, there's various ways to skin a cat, and it could have been drawn in a more a more varied way than that, but I'm not sure it would have made a lot of difference in the end.
And in terms of progressive revegetation and natives, how long would it take from planting of native vegetation to have a meaningful vegetation barrier in the locations where that doesn't currently exist?
Oh, well, if we choose a part of that 20 metre wide buffer that has no high vegetation in it, quite a long time. But I'd say there's not many of those. And again, there are other layers of mitigation on top of that 20 metre buffer. But yeah, I think your implication is correct, that the revegetation of that buffer strip to become a self-sustaining body of native dominated vegetation, that's a long-term goal.
Are we talking 5 years? Talking 10 years? Are we talking decades?
Yeah, well, we're talking decades, really, for a full yes. But then I guess that's going to be linked to whatever development occurs, and of course it's already treed, very largely already treed in mature trees that even in winter it's pretty difficult to look through, and I suppose depending on what development occurs in what parts of the zone, there'll be a resource consent process that has gone through, and vegetation appropriate to that development will be required.
One other question for you. I was mulling this over listening to you. Like, I get the clear message. The Burdens can't turn around on the leased land without council approval. Which, as you say, can't take out any trees, like, and everything they want to do is a major drama. So never mind the RMA process. One consequence of that is that I foresee that there would be a considerable incentive to utilise the 7% building coverage to locate buildings on the private land that wouldn't be subject to council approval because it's zoned. Like, I appreciate that's not the vision, but in term in terms of your view as firstly the landscape architect, I want to ask Mr. White the same question. What's in the planning provisions to stop that happening? Sort of basically overloading the private land with a disproportionate share of the 7% building coverage, because the 7% is for the zone, not for the individual blocks.
Well, yeah, in my understanding, there's nothing to prevent that happening other than the fact that we've already got a pile of buildings inside the leased land that are taking up part of the 7%. And I guess if more buildings occur, they'll take up more of that 7%. But, of course, there is a resource consent process to go through each time. And the freehold land that's not part of the lease, when we take out that 20-metre buffer strip, it's quite a narrow strip, and the area of it that has a decent buildable area is really the most hidden part of the zone. So that's part of the motivation for there being a higher building height allowance in that part of the zone. And also it's topographically well hidden. So if there were two-storey buildings there that end up taking up more of their share of the 7% than might otherwise be the case, then I don't think that's a problem, subject to the resource consent process that they have to go through anyway.
Which is only a controlled activity.
Yes.
So that's limited to what the council can do to discourage a clumping of buildings or the aggregation of 500 square metre buildings in certain areas.
Well, that's right, but the controls, I mean, I don't think the clumping is the problem. I think if they're clumped in that area, that's probably not a bad thing. I doubt whether it would really all happen that way, but if that happened, I don't think that's a bad thing. The controls in respect of building design and earthworks and landscaping on top of these provisions in the 20-metre buffer, I guess, give me the comfort.
Can we not lose sight of the fact, too, that glamping tents, which you've seen, are a building in terms of the definition under the Act?
Yes.
So when we're talking about site coverage, they are all included.
I understand when you say clumping's not a problem. I think Mrs. Burden made it clear that that's in fact what they envisaged. What I wondered is not that everything had to be proportionate, but that the plan provisions as they stand would permit an excessive level of disproportion, and whether that might be quite simply headed off with some specific plan, a bit of tweaking of those plan provisions. Do you think that that might be desirable?
Well, I guess it could be done. I can't see any impediment to that. It makes the provisions a bit more complex, I suppose, but I don't know if that's a problem. I guess I just wonder whether it's really necessary to offset any landscape effect. As I say, the part of the freehold land that is really the buildable area is really the most hidden part of the site. So,
on that point, the other issue is that northern area where we went on and stood at effectively the southern edge. It's quite a strange shape, but there's a mound that's taken in. I'd like call it a hammer. The handle is like a mound. So, and there's a flat area further off the lake, and we stood on the lake and looked straight back at the road. And you can, it's more than you can see the road, you can see the tarmac of the road. And in terms of your point that the freehold land is the most hidden area, completely understand your point as regards the strip that separated the leased land from the highway. But as regards that northern slope, whether that's the exception, whether that's relatively visible from the road.
Well, yes, that's right. That part is different, and it's parts of it are more visible from the road, and parts of it aren't. So, yes, that's right.
Commissioner Hill.
Nothing further from me, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
In relation to Ms. Gilbert's recommendations or her concerns, you've talked with the chair about the buffer along the highway edge. What is there to create, or is it necessary to create a buffer along the lakefront edge? She expresses concern about a need for sort of, I suppose, more cementing in a landscape buffer with a building BRA along the lakefront edge of the site.
Yeah, well, that was thought about, and that area was examined in a bit of detail. I've got in front of me a plan. Well, it's actually appended to my evidence, I think, that shows the zone as a colour, and then the on top of an aerial photograph, and you can see that the lake edge and a reasonable strip there, probably about, looking at the 20 metre wide buffer, I'd say about a 30 odd metre wide strip of lake edge is actually Lynn's land, administered by Lynn's I believe administered by Lynn's. Outside of the proposed zone.
Mm. I mean, some places that's clearly heavily treed, and in other places it's not.
Yes.
You know, there are sort of lengths where that buffer doesn't contain that strip of Lynn's land doesn't contain trees. I mean, do you think, I mean, in your view, is a buffer necessary anymore along there, other than what's provided for on the Lynn's land? Because the rules that Mr. White's proposing don't cover the side, they only cover the state highway buffer.
The rules to do with the vegetation management and so on. Yeah, yes, that's right. Yeah, well, as I say, this was looked at and examined, and ultimately, I suppose, I ended at the position that, well, I don't think we need any specific treatment along there, because of a combination of things, I suppose, the Lynn's land and then the land that is separated from the lake by the Lynn's land but is the next piece of land that looks at the lake is all council-owned block, which is relatively well treed, and again the council has control over the trees and over other aspects of what happens on that land as owners of it. Yeah, ultimately I decided I don't think we need anything extra there. I mean, I suppose there could be, and that might reinforce the controls that already exist anyway, but I didn't see that anything extra was needed there.
You keep coming back to this reliance on council control of trees within the reserve or the leased land. What if the council changed its mind? Say, well, I don't care. We don't care.
really?
I mean, to what extent? I mean, to what extent are your recommendations about this land, about the management of the vegetation and the park-like sort of atmosphere, the visibility into the zone, either from the lake or from the town or from the highway, reliant on the council's current management of the trees?
Well, yeah, they're reliant on it. I've talked through that with with the legal and planning advisors in formulating my opinions, and I think from the highway not so much, but from the lake and from Hawea, if all council control was going to be removed and wasn't going to happen, then yeah, I'd say we need different provisions in the zone.
All right. So, well, I mean, I guess it's not for you, but for Mr. White and Mr. Totten, this, in my experience, unusual to, when you've got a zoning regime, to rely on the landowner as the controller of the management of a fence. And you know, I'll be interested in why you think that's appropriate on this site. But yes, you're saying you are reliant on it.
For those effects, as viewed from the east, yeah, I guess I am reliant on it. As I say, I've taken advice on that, and it's sort of outside my area. But as I understand it, there's the ownership is one thing, then there's the lease, and then there's the designation. So I suppose it's a combination of all those. But well, yes, you may well be right. I don't know.
It's not,
I mean,
it's not the intention to retain those designations.
Yeah, I mean, I have relied on, I suppose, the combination of those things. In formulating my opinion.
That's all, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Warren.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley.
Thank you.
I look forward to talking to you again tonight.
Yes, daily just exercise.
Just while Commissioner Dawson is making your notes and looking at that, I note that this was not an issue. At all with respect to the rezoning of the land for community
development.
Or the issue about the issue that we've just been debating.
But the building controls are quite strict in that zone.
The building controls
are very strict in that zone.
It depends in terms of what you're terming as buildings. And that's exactly why the reason I raised with four is so that you're aware that a glamping tent in that area. And I would have thought that glamping tents and a camping ground would have been something which normally should be quite straightforward in terms of development. And we've already heard evidence from Mrs. Burden and Mr. Burden as to what extreme lengths they had to go to get consent for those from under the Resource Management Act.
Yes. What I'm thinking is that under the informal community purpose zone camping ground, the total maximum ground floor area of buildings per site, so that's a per legal title, so that's what it's quite, is 600 square metres. And beyond that, it's a restricted discretionary.
Yeah, that's the reason why we appeal the zone.
Yes,
because for a camping ground, why would you possibly have a total limit of development over 15 hectares of 600 square metres.
Okay, well, just putting that to one side, you're saying that the cutting down of trees, the reliance on the council as the lessee to manage the level of building development and therefore the management of the amount of tree removal, etc., or landscaping around those buildings, wasn't a concern at the time of the community purpose zone hearing. Well, it's because the controls in that zone don't make it a concern.
No.
Whereas in this zone, you're wanting 7% building coverage, which is, as they keep saying, the 31,500 square metre buildings. So the context between those two zones makes the issues different.
Well, with the gross respect, I don't think it does, because this is something we've debated with council's planners and landscape architects for the last 3 years. So, for example, I could totally cover that site with caravans, tents, motorhomes, anything in the summer, as of right, over that period of time. In fact, if camping was popular all year round, I could do it as of right because of the site, because it's a camping ground.
Because they're not buildings.
Yeah, it's a camping ground. But I can't do that with a tent, a glamping tent, which is situated on a platform which is raised 50 centimetres off the ground. And this is the problem.
I understand that.
We're talking about
different things in
a way.
We're talking about different aspects here. Yeah.
Well, I don't think we are, because surely, in terms of your assessment, you have to take what is effectively the underlying use of that land currently. You can't ignore that. It's totally artificial to ignore that in my submission. It is also totally artificial to ignore the fact that Mr. Espy has tried to point out to you that a significant part of the land on the lakeshore is outside of the control of my client or the council.
He's very clearly pointed that out. Yeah. That's the Lynn's land you're talking about.
It is.
Yeah, mm. And he showed me the map of this where that's clear.
Mr. White.
I do have a summary that's been presented earlier. Most of those things have already been covered in some form in the preceding discussion. Would you like me to go through that again?
Well, I don't think so.
Would you like just to answer questions on
the amount of time that's rolling by? I think if you feel that the matters in your summary have been covered to your satisfaction already, I think it would be more productive to ask. Answer the question, let's start with Commissioner Dawson's question. As a planner, and we've heard Mr. Todd's submission.
Mm-hmm.
As a planner, are you comfortable relying on the exercise of council controls outside the RMA process, and why?
Okay.
Assuming you are, then why? Okay. That's the why is the key point.
I don't think that was my point. Because you still have control in the RMA process. You have a next level of control through the council.
That's what we want to explore,
yes.
Mr. White.
Yes.
Let's be clear about this. Let's imagine that the site wasn't owned by council and they had no control except through what was proposed under the proposed zoning. That's not the case, but let's work on that as a presumption. In this case, the zoning is set back from the edge of the lake by a margin that's at least 20 metres. So that's land that's owned by Lynn's. On top of that, it's proposed through the normal rural visitor zone rules to have a setback distance of 10 metres. So you've got a minimum of 20 plus your 10 anyway. And then
from the site boundary.
From the site boundary.
That's on the lake side.
That's on the lake side, but would also apply on the highway side, although that 10 metres would all be within the 20 metre proposed buffer. So it's not so much of an issue on the highway side. So that's your setback. Then on top of that, there is proposed controls on height. That, if you look at the third A3 sheet, the area next to the lake is proposed to be subject to a 5.5 metre high building limit. So we're talking about quite low buildings to begin with. Then we have the difference in site coverage that's possible under the campground zone and the proposed rural visitor zone. And there being some quite significant differences between the site coverage provisions under the open space zone and under the designation, which are actually more restrictive in a lot of cases in the proposed rural visitor zone, particularly site coverage.
Well, just on the designation, my understanding is that the council bringing in zones over its reserves was instead of having them designated. Like previously they might have been rural zone with a designation on all their reserves. And in part two, stage two, they brought in zoning over them all, different zonings, with an eye to removing those designations in time. Is that your understanding?
I'm not sure that the strategic thinking behind the open zone, but when I came to this district working originally from a district that had open space zones, it always looked to me to be anomaly that council didn't zone its reserves and instead relied on the provisions of the designation.
Yes.
So I'm if it's moving towards a situation of less reliance on designations for open space, I think that's a good thing in general.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean that's we can't guarantee what the council will do about its designations, but it has brought in this zone, which at the moment acts in, as well as the designations that have been in the operative's plan.
Mm-hmm.
But the zone, I mean, as I understood it at the time, the zone was to be the matter of the means of managing them rather than doing all the management of those areas through the designation. So the fact that the building coverage was 40% in the designation has now been at least not, if not overtaken by, then certainly put alongside a building coverage in the zone, which is not 40% at all. So when I look at the impact of the 7% building coverage, I'm not actually comparing it so much with the 40%, although it's still there. I'm comparing it with what I understand you're not the client's not happy with, but is a total of 600 square metres. Which must be a lot less than 0.7%.
I'm quite happy with your assessment on that too.
Yes. Okay.
Mm. The other point I was going to relate to about the effects was the existing activity on the site and the fact that there are caravans and there are tents and there are and those, yes, they are transient, they come and they go, and they're particularly there over summer, but they do already have a level of effect and demonstrate use of that site. So we're not talking about a completely empty baseline.
You're talking about a permitted baseline.
And it's not just existing use, it's actually permitted use under the camping zone, isn't it?
It is, and one that's actually encouraged.
Yes, yeah, the purpose of the zone.
Is that the answer, or one of the answers to Mr. Todd's point, that it's part of the permitted baseline? It should be being taken into account, although obviously we know that Section 104 provides a discretion.
In relation to resource consent application, yeah.
Going back to the question I posed to Mr. Espy, is it desirable to head off excessive, or in effect gaming of the coverage, shifting or overweighting the private land with building coverage because of the difficulties posed by getting council consent on the leased land?
That is certainly something to be mindful of, and perhaps that's something that we should have a look at in relation to the rule drafting.
Is that a qualified yes?
Yeah, there's a qualified yes.
How would you imagine?
I'm not quite sure yet, but I think you could make it more either relate it back to the building height area, or look at tweaking one of the rules so it applies within a certain distance from the highway or something along those lines.
What about making 7% of each title?
That's a possibility. In that case, what would that do?
That was all I had, Commissioner Dawson Carroll.
Some of your policy amendments relate to the whole zone. like removing generally remote and location and difficult to see from public places from policy. Your suggestion that it's removed from 4621A.
Mm-hmm.
assessment have you done of the impact of that?
The real question I had about remoteness in a in an objectives and policy sense is, what is remote? What does it actually mean? As we've heard this morning, your version of remote and my version of remote might be different.
So what is? So what happens then? Okay, so we just cut it out. But isn't? I mean, what? How have you analysed the impact of just taking out all sense of remoteness, whatever that might mean, or difficult to see from the policies? I mean, what does that mean for future RV zones across the district?
I'm not sure that makes much difference here, because that the provision applies to the rural visitor zones themselves, so they've got to have gone through either a plan change or a district plan process to have been determined to have been suitable for that particular site.
Yes, but that determination is based on the wording of the policies, and that those wording, you're suggesting removing those wording from the policies, so it actually opens up possible sites more widely than the zone had been as the zone had been notified.
Mm.
So it opens up all sorts of other possibilities for this zone.
Yeah.
To be consistent, where they might not have been consistent with these policies in the past, and as notified, I mean.
Mm.
So what's that? What's the impact of that?
Well, haven't you? I'm not sure it's significant, because then the policy goes on to say areas of lower landscape sensitivity with areas of moderate to high. So you've already taken those factors into account.
So, I mean, I've asked other people, what, I mean, if you looked at the rural, the RCL, or the parts, I mean, I know this site is OML, and that was one of the notified provisions. But if, I mean, even in OML, but certainly in RCL areas, have you assessed how many other areas there are of lower landscape sensitivity?
No.
No. So if you're not, and so if they don't have to be remote and they don't have to be difficult to see, all they have to be is lower landscape sensitivity. And you don't really know what that, you haven't told us what the implications of changing that focus is in terms of how many other sites could come along under this zoning.
That's correct.
So are you trying to make changes that apply across the zone, or are you really looking to apply this zone to this site?
The purpose of the submission is to apply the rural visitor zone to the site.
Yes.
As opposed to a more general provision.
More general provision. So if we were to think about it in those two different ways, the emphasis in your evidence for your client is on this site, as opposed to trying to change the zone as a whole.
Correct.
All right. I mean, do you want? I didn't ask Ms. Espy the remote question, but I mean, what's your version of whether this site is remote or not as a planner?
And I start to answer that by saying I'm not sure that remote is something that's you should put into a policy context, because
but it
it's.
Is.
But that's
it is. So we've got it there in the proposed plan, unless you accept your submission to take it out.
Or, and the various other submissions that have to try the same thing. I've got a problem with remote, what it means, and its subjectivity. And are you talking about remoteness from a main centre? Are you talking about remoteness from hardware? Or are you talking about isolation?
Well, I mean, I know you might have a problem with it, but say you had to, given that the word is in the proposed zone that you're asking for your client's land, how do you interpret it for the site?
If you're looking at it, say, in the context of a resource consent application for buildings on the site, it's not that applicable.
No,
because
it's a plan change.
It's an overarching policy that deals with the suitability of sites for the zone.
Yes.
zoning it effectively means that any site that within that zone is consistent with that objective for a policy anyway. So at a consent level, it's not that significant and it's not an impediment.
No, it's not. The purpose of the word is to try and identify those sites that are appropriate for this zoning, not once it's zoned, to look at activities within the zone. So how do you, if you can't answer, just say, and I won't keep pestering you about it. But do you think that the site has any aspect of remoteness that would say the zoning is appropriate on it?
Well, you could look at it as being remote from Hawea, given it's separate from the town and distinct from the town.
Okay, I won't labour this anymore. I just want to ask you about a couple of your rules. I'm interested in how your vegetation management rule works. You've got a standard that says a vegetation management plan shall be developed. But it reads a bit like a condition on a resource consent or something, because a standard has to apply to an activity. So how do you see this vegetation management plan coming into being? What activity does it attach to and when?
I had seen this vegetation management plan being developed as part of the first resource consent application for a building.
It doesn't say that though, does it?
Any building in the zone is a controlled activity,
yes.
And where the vegetation management plan's not previously been provided, the application becomes a non-complying activity. So that gives you a real incentive to create it first up.
I find this sort of array of writing conditions quite convoluted. I mean, standards quite convoluted. Are you saying that every building in the zone needs to be in accordance with a vegetation management plan?
I'm thinking that the vegetation management is created as part of the first building, and then...
And then every other building that comes along has to...
Has to look at the vegetation management plan and determine that the building is inappropriate or is still appropriate in the light of that plan. And it may be that the plan, because it's intended to apply long term, continues to be developed.
Okay, but you don't. Am I right that you haven't written it quite like that, have you? It doesn't say build the first building after this zone becomes operative or whatever, must have a vegetation plan attached to it, and then it needs, and then every subsequent building you need to go back and find that somehow in the archives of the council to check that it's consistent with it.
It's not worded that way, but there, as I said before, the encouragement is that if it's not there, any other applications for buildings will be a non-compliant.
Okay, you don't really understand what I'm talking about in terms of the structural way of writing this.
I can see what you're doing there in proposing it. And
okay, but that's
the effect, I think, is the same.
The first building must have a vegetation plan as a standard,
mm-hmm.
And then every other building from then on, that same vegetation plan must be adhered to.
Must be considered.
But it's a standard. It's not a considered, it has to be adhered to. Or are you just saying that it's a matter of control? Because that's the difficulty, you're muddling up matter of control on buildings with a standard. sort of get a bit of a better understanding about what you mean. But this vegetation land is only for the state highway buffer, isn't it?
It is, yes.
So any planting requirements relating to the buildings
mm-hmm.
would need to come through this control reserve on landscaping. Landscape, cultural and heritage and visual amenity values under the controlled activity. So is that the only place where other vegetation management gets picked up?
It is, yes.
Yeah,
and
so
if you look
under
at
the controlled activity provision.
Yes, and
yes.
If you look specifically at 46.47.
Yes.
There's
there.
Compatibility with landscape and amenity values is proposed there, as is.
Landscape and planting in B as well.
Yep, and also we're proposing another control in there as well, consistency with the approved vegetation management.
But that's just to do with the highway buffer.
It is.
Yes, okay. And then. So when you're talking about a structure plan, you're basically just talking about the BRA and the two height areas here.
That plan there.
Which is this in
yep.
the back view area.
Yes.
So it's going quite a little, it's pushing what a structure plan is. I mean, if you just use the word structure plan, because that's a word that's used in the district plan to date.
Yes.
Because a lot of the structure plans have a lot more detail in them than this, don't
they? They do,
yeah.
Yep.
But are you relying on the controlled activity subdivision that comes with having a structure plan?
There's no subdivision proposed.
Well, but that's not to say that it might happen.
That's true, but we've heard this morning that's not the intention of the...
Right, so no, it's not intended to subdivide and have the controlled activity route that the structure plan brings.
No, it's not. No,
yeah,
correct.
Because that's a huge advantage of having a structure plan, especially when it doesn't say much. It's easy to be consistent with it. So the subdivision status changes automatically under the subdivision change.
I actually hadn't even considered subdivision.
Well, a lot of other people have.
Mm.
Okay, but that's not an intended pathway that you're
no.
pursuing. Okay.
Couple for me, Mr. White, and I'll start with the rules first. You're suggesting, this is in your table, restaurants, cafes be specifically identified, and I'm looking at the definition of visitor accommodation, which seems to include those things, and in fact is slightly broader. What's the purpose of actually specifying it?
To be specific, to make them and anticipate
right.
the outcome, as opposed to relying on interpretation of the definitions.
So you're concerned about it then? We had this discussion this morning with Mr. Williams. Are you concerned that the definition is not clear enough? It seems to include service facilities directly associated, etc., food preparation, dining and sanitary facilities, not sure why they're combined together, conference bar facilities, etc., etc. It seems to me to cover a restaurant or a bar or a cafe, but is that not the case?
Well, it seems to.
Right.
But the purpose of this is to make it specific.
So when I say, and your law is specific, says accessory to a permitted activity.
Yep.
The definition seems to go broader than that because it says it doesn't actually have to be.
That was because we're talking about a specific type of activity that occurs
right.
within the banner of the rural visitor zone.
So you think it's clear having it here and it doesn't create a confusion because of the definition?
I think it's clearer.
Okay. Right.
The way we drafted it.
I just want to go back very briefly to the remote and the policy. You haven't recommended taking that term out of the purpose, only out of the policy. And is that because, if I interpret your answers to Commissioner Dawson correctly, you think the policy, in terms of a consenting, it's already zoned, so what's the purpose of that zone? Is that why you're suggesting taking it out of the policy and not the purpose? Or is it just an oversight not taking it out of the purpose as well?
No, I think you're quite right with your interpretation there, that it's fine to sit within the intention for the zone, but not necessary to apply as an objective for a policy.
Right. So my final question, just on that, is this issue that Commissioner Dawson raised that we've been raising is, does this open it up to a whole wider range of where the zone might be considered appropriate? And if, I'm just saying, if it's an issue, having it in the policy is a stronger case when it comes to private plan changes who might seek to leverage off the policy where it's quite a broad one.
That's correct.
So, I mean, in that case, would it not be better if you accept in the purpose that it's to be remote, isn't it better to have it in the policy as well so that when it came to, say, potentially private plan changes, the council would have a stronger or more robust basis on which to say whether it's acceptable or not?
You're quite right, and that's a bigger issue than the more site-specific intention for the changes to the rural visitor zone proposed to this submission and evidence.
Right, thank you.
Commissioner McLeod?
Just wondering, the 10-metre setback from the Lynn zone,
mm-hmm.
where does it specify that? Can you point me to where that is? Because it's not on the structural plan.
So the standards for the...
Yes, if you look in the standards for the rural visitor zone,
yes.
4656, buildings shall be set back a minimum of 10 metres from the zone boundary,
yeah.
Page 46A.
So that's the bed of a river, lake or wetland shall be 20 metres.
Next one, immediately underneath that.
Not a place to trust the buildings. Please, we're sitting in 10 minutes, there's no land in the culture. Okay, that's it, thanks.
I think that's it.
Thank you.
Mr. Todd, you and your team, Mr. Burton, nice to see you again. Time is marching on, but I think we should hear the Waterfall Creek residents. Mr. Devlin, I think, mind having lunch before we hear you? Or are you doing both? The Waterfall Creek team are in the rear. So. You've had a long, hopefully
okay.
Patient wait.
Good discussion.
Please read the statement.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Ella Louise Hardman. I am a resource management planner for Southern Land Limited. I have been engaged by Jan Hyten, Hilary Johnson, Rob and Jean Johnson, Malcolm and Sally Law, Lloyd and Debs Mortius, Kim and Simon Marshall and Mark and Tanya Simmons to provide a statement in relation to their further submission lodged on the 5th of March. Since the further submission was lodged, the further submitters have had the benefit of receiving Council's Section 42 report prepared by Emily Grace, along with Council's expert witness evidence prepared by Robert Bond, geotechnical engineer, and Matthew Jones, landscape architect. The submission site, Lot 1 DP 367753, comprises 34 hectares of land located at 280 Wanaka Mount Aspiring Road and is otherwise known as Barn Pinch Farm. The site also includes the Olive Grove, a weddings and events venue. The submission site is surrounded by rural and rural lifestyle zoned land. The site is currently zoned rural general under the operative Queenstown Lakes District Plan and rural zone under the proposed district plan. The site includes a portion of land identified as outstanding natural landscape, which is contained within a QE2 National Trust Covenant area. In their submission, the Blennerhassetts have sought to rezone the site to rural visitor zone and to amend the policy and rule framework of Chapter 46 to allow for residential activity alongside visitor accommodation activities and to enable land outside of an outstanding natural landscape to be accommodated within the rural visitor zone. As outlined in the further submission, the further submitters consider that the relief sought by the submitter in relation to the rezoning of the submission site to rural visitor zone and the accommodation of residential activity alongside visitor accommodation does not align with the purpose, objectives or policies of the rural visitor zone and therefore should be disallowed. The rural visitor zone is not appropriate in relation to the submission site because the site is not a remote location and the site is unable to absorb the effects of development without compromising the landscape value of the district as required by the purpose of the rural visitor zone. Rezoning of the site to rural visitor zone would provide for substantially more built form within the site than could currently be anticipated and would provide for the construction of buildings associated with visitor accommodation as a controlled activity whereby Council must, in most circumstances, grant consent subject to conditions being imposed. Controlled activity status in relation to the construction of future development would reduce Council's ability to decline applications based on adverse landscape effects. The rural visitor zone provides for up to 15 flights per week from anywhere within the site as a permitted activity. At present, due to the proximity of the site to surrounding residential units and in relation to rules regarding informal airports, far fewer flights would be anticipated. Increased flights under the rural visitor zone would negatively impact surrounding properties, and due to the permitted nature of flights, no mitigation measures could be required to protect the amenity of surrounding properties. The natural hazard identified within the site requires site and proposal specific assessment that cannot be provided at plan level. Therefore, the appropriateness of the location within the site and mitigation proposed should only be assessed in relation to a specific proposal under discretionary status as is currently provided by the rural zone. The rural visitor zone manages landscape effects through location. While the current rural zone uses discretionary status to manage effects on landscape, at this point and based on Council's expert evidence provided by Mr. Jones, it is not possible to identify that the site can protect, maintain or enhance landscape values. Therefore, the current rural zoning is more appropriate and allows applications for future development to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. The proposed amendments to the policy and rule framework for Chapter 46 to provide for residential activity alongside visitor accommodation are unclear and would be contrary to the purpose of the rural visitor zoning. The current rural zoning is appropriate and allows for applications for residential and visitor accommodation activities to be assessed on a case-by-case basis under a discretionary activity and provides council with greater control and discretion in terms of mitigation of adverse landscape and amenity effects.
Thank you, Ms. Harden. I observed that we have no evidence in support of the submission you're responding to.
Correct.
We have the evidence from the council team opposing. We now have your evidence overlaid on that. For my part, I don't have any questions or in the, to get to that I think need clarification.
Yeah, I have nothing.
I mean, the only thing I'd like to just make sure I know which properties it relates to and which your clients,
yes,
their zoners.
They are.
Can you call up? Have you got an address on Mount Aspiring Road?
Yes, 280 Mount Aspiring Road, next to Ripon.
Kat will just call that up. 280 Mount Aspiring Road.
Yeah.
It would be remiss of us not to have a conversation about remote or general.
We're not going to go there, thank you.
I'm ready.
We've been there, done that.
It's been so long.
And pull out so we can see where.
So there, below, if you click on 280 just quickly, so you can see where that one is, up from where the upslide. Yeah. So it's all of the properties below, on the other side of the.
All the other side of Mount Aspiring Road.
Correct.
From 280.
Yeah, within the rural lifestyle zone, mostly.
Some of them are rural lifestyle and some of them are large lot.
I believe couple on the end might be large lot.
Oh, okay, but mostly your clients are the ones down in that rural lifestyle.
Just at the foot of, I guess, the Mount Roy side of Mount Roy.
And the barn pinch farm is the farm between the vineyard that you can see on there
and Waterfall Creek or the Ruby
Island.
Yes.
Your Ruby Island, right, I think it is.
Yeah, correct.
And the houses mostly elevated along on the south side?
Mostly, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harper. That's it. Mr. Devlin, we've been hard at it. Do you mind if we have some lunch?
No, that's fine with us. We'll definitely just be 10 minutes, though.
Well,
if you want to soldier on, I don't want you to be.
Can we soldier on?
Crack on.
The answer of the team is crack on.
As long as you don't have a conversation about the remote.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Back to Arthur's Point in Queenstown. I know you've been focused on Wanaka and Hawea. I've pre-circulated a short statement last week, just checking you've all got
which
there.
We've now read.
Yes,
which we've
great.
Already read.
So just today I'm going to briefly run through that. It'll just take a minute or two. I'd like to introduce the submitters, the property owners. We've got Sam Rees and Alan Rees here who know the history of the property and can speak to that much better than I. And we've also just bringing up the site on the map, but we've got the circle thinking there. So I'll push on anyway. So property is owned by Mandalia Properties Limited and Goldstream Properties Limited at 164 Arthur's Point Road. It's 2.8 hectares. Shown in my figure one, it is one of the largest, mostly vacant sites. It does have a single residential unit on it, but as you can see from the aerial photo there, it's largely undeveloped. And I would just note that the submission was prepared by the property group, but I've been engaged by the submitter, and because this wasn't able to be pre-circulated, this isn't submitted as expert evidence. So the submission that was lodged sought that the operative rural visitor zone be reinstated over the property. Since that time, we've received the 42A report, and that recommends a mixture of high and medium density on the site, which is shown in my figure two there. The submitter is satisfied that recommended rezoning to high and medium density addresses their concerns that were lodged in the submission with the loss of an operative rural visitor zone, but would still seek some changes, which I'll go on to describe, to the 42A version of those provisions. So with regard to the location of the rural recommended zoning and the consequent O&L line that you can see in my figure two there, clearly this is based on the evidence of Ms. Melsop, and Ms. Melsop opposes the rezoning, which was to keep the operative rural visitor zone from a landscape perspective, and Ms. Turner and Venice, that's the evidence before her, she's adopted that. I would just like to draw to the panel's attention that whilst I understand why Ms. Turner's adopted that approach, there are some other considerations that I think come to bear on the location of that O&L line and the subsequent zone boundary. So in figure three below, I have just illustrated development on either side of the property, and probably the bottom image there in figure three illustrates how the, you know, this rural zoning with the O&L line is a sort of peninsula of rural zone into what is now recommended to be a mix of high and medium density. So applying more of a, you know, planning lens to that landscape assessment, there is that existing built development on either side of the site. And in figure four there, I've shown the council's line, which is the dotted red, and a proposed alternative which follows the 427 metre contour. And just to emphasise here that the recommended line does actually track up the contours to get up to that terrace edge. So Ms. Melsop's clearly stated in her evidence that the terrace edge is where the O&L line is, and I think from a purely landscape perspective, she's got good grounds there. I guess taking into account more of the receiving environment, like what's actually happened around the site, my submission to you is that the green line, the 427 metre contour, is actually a better location for that boundary. It would enable more development of the site, it would be more consistent with that operative rural visitor zone, and it would reduce the impact of the proposed downzoning on the submitter. And visually, I submit it would align better with that development on either side, specifically the onsen hot pools and just a residential unit to the east. And in Ms. Melsop's report, she does acknowledge that where adjoining development has spilled over that escarpment, as is the case on either side, that those areas have more capacity to absorb development, and my submission to you would be so just a bit in between those two areas. So just to wrap it up, I will read my conclusion. In conclusion, the submitter sought that the notified provisions be rejected and the more enabling rural visitor zone provisions from the operative district plan be retained. The changes recommended by the Section 42A author to provide for high density residential on the upper part of the site and medium density residential on a small portion of the eastern part of the site without a bird line restriction are similar in many respects to the operative district plan rural visitor zone and are now supported, recognising that the high-density zone, high-density residential zone does anticipate visitor accommodation. A large portion of the site remains downzoned from rural visitor in the ODP to rural outstanding natural landscape. The submitter requests that a pragmatic approach be taken with regard to the location of the O&L line in this location, as it veers significantly into the submitted property when compared with adjoining land. While it is accepted that the O&L location is based on the evidence of Ms. Malsop, it is thought that rather than following the topographic terrace edge, having the high-density residential zoning follow that 427-metre contour line, as shown in Figure 4 and in a larger version in Appendix 2, would better reflect development on adjoining land, enable additional residential development of the site, and better align with the operative rural visitor zoning, meaning less of a downzoning, which has consequent financial implications for the submitter. Just before we go on to questions, I would just, my first attachment there is an old subdivision plan that didn't ever proceed, but I included it because it had the contour information on it, and it also showed the formation of the access track. So just to note that there is quite good vehicle access down to that 427-metre contour that I've referred to, and that's informed our reasoning around why that's a good zone boundary, because it is accessible, that part of the site. It's definitely sloping, but as you've seen on the sites next door at Onsen, Hot Pools and elsewhere, it's not a deal-breaker, the slope. It is developable. And also just to note, on that plan you'll see an easement area E, which is a long, thin access that goes down the side of the site. That is also actually formed up into a vehicle access. So there is actually a loop down from the flat upper terrace down easement area E and along the access track that cuts along the site and back up. So just to... The reason I included that survey plan was just to show that that steeper part of the site, you can't really see it because of the dense vegetation, but it is accessible and it is there are opportunities there for housing and for development. So ignore the proposed subdivision. That was an old plan from 2009. As you can see, it was more just to show you the contour data. So, just Alan or Sam, if there's anything you want to add, now's your chance.
We've had the block for 20 years, and we've been waiting for the merging buildings to come out to us to see what sort of fit was most suitable for the land, and totally agree with the high density areas, very suitable, but we seem to have got most of it taken away with this ONL, which we've been controlling pests and keeping an eye on the wilding pines, etc., hoping to get rid of them all and change them with natives, as we were going to build some ecopods in these areas. And at the moment, we can't. And yet it's a very suitable place for them to be built. So the land will just probably go to waste, whereas we're prepared to maintain it and run it as a family business. That area, that's at the bottom.
Thank you, Mr. Rees. Devlin, as you know, location of an O&L lines is peculiarly landscape business, or the business of expert landscapers. You're labouring under a disadvantage putting this information before us in the absence of any landscape evidence, is the reality that you're relying, and you've given lots of detail, that you're relying on the council team packing this up and agreeing with the wisdom of your reasoning?
To a degree, but I guess I've tried to explain that I understand why Ms. Millsop landed on the terrace edge as the boundary. Totally accept that. She also noted that, you know, where development has already come down that terrace escarpment, that those areas have more capacity to absorb development, and this site happens to be in between those. So drawing on Ms. Millsop's own evidence and applying more of a planning lens to it, recognising that existing development, but also noting that this isn't expert planning evidence before you. So I guess Ms. Turner's just accepted Ms. Millsop's advice of critique that a little bit more with more of a, you know, receiving environment type lens on it. But except there's no other landscape evidence before you.
Thank you.
Nothing to do with me.
You haven't had a chance to discuss your amended proposal with Ms. Turner or Ms. Millsop?
No, because I was just engaged on this last week, but I can do that though, because I wasn't sure if she'd be here today, but looks like Amy's on duty here. So that probably be, I'm sure she'll listen to the recording, but I should pick up the phone and talk to her as well.
Well, I'm not going to direct that you conference with her, because yours is not evidence. You will be as alive as we are, that might be a very wise thing for you to do.
Duly noted. Mm.
Just endorse that comment. No more questions from me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Reese.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And to Mr. Deirdre.
Looking at, options on the site.
And confirming the past.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
week
indeed.
Six.
It's been a long morning.
Week six, day two.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.